As you start to reach more people, things start to feel more complex. There's more to do and more to keep track of, and it starts to actually take time away from creating content. I felt this struggle personally. The more creator science grew, the more it felt like I was dropping the ball. So I did something about it. I built a set of rock-solid systems, all in Notion, to support the business as we grew, and it worked like a charm. I've now taken my personal Notion setup and productized it. It's called Creator HQ, and it's the complete operating system that you need for your creator business. I built Creator HQ to be an all-in-one workspace designed to save you more time, create more content, and drive more revenue. By leveraging Creator HQ, we are publishing more than we ever have, and we're nearing $1 million in annual revenue because of it. It brings all of your data and processes into one place with custom-built dashboards to reduce friction in managing tasks, creating content, and collaborating with your team. I've seriously spent more than 3 years building this, and now you can have the same systems that I use right out of the box. In the lab, one of our members just posted, "I have spent the last few weeks diving into Creator HQ, learning how it works, and making it my own. This is the first time in a while that I've felt this organized and filled with hope that I can find a workflow that will work for me with my whole business. This is gold. I will definitely be giving a testimonial for this badass product." If you're new to Notion, don't worry. I've included a ton of specific tutorials to help you learn how to use Notion generally and Creator HQ specifically. I've never seen another Notion product integrate tutorials like we have here. More than 300 other creators are already using Creator HQ, and I am not exaggerating when I say I would be lost without this system. Creator HQ is what keeps the trains running over here. As a podcast listener, I'm giving you my best price. You can get 10% off using the promo code PODCAST at checkout. Just head to creatorhq.co to watch the video and learn more. That's creatorhq.co and use promo code PODCAST to save 10%.
Are viral videos the best way to grow your channel?
How do you make videos that engage your audience?
In this video, my producer Connor and I answer all your questions about YouTube and building a creator business.
We talk about getting sponsors and how we craft our podcast intros,
pivoting your content, and more.
Home Rapid Repair asks, when growing your YouTube channel, would you rather have a viral hit and sensational content or the slow burners that create a loyal following, however long it takes you to build?
Well, first, I kind of want to call out something I disagree with the premise of this question. I don't think having a viral hit and making sensational content is necessarily synonymous. I think you can have a viral hit without having it be sensational, because I would say in general, I'm personally not interested in making sensational content, but that doesn't mean that we can't have some viral hits. Our video with Jenny Hoyos is at 2.5 million views now, which is what, like 25x our next most popular video, or like 20x our most next popular video. And from that video alone, last time I checked, we had picked up 30,000 subscribers of our now 77,000. So that is awesome that nearly half of our channel can be attributed to this one video. But there's also some challenges that come with that. In particular, if I'm somebody that watches Jenny Hoyos' video about shorts, and I subscribe to the Creator Science channel, I'm likely expecting to get more videos that teach me about shorts. And as a creator, you're kind of incentivized to lean into that. And we see a lot of people do this, where they have something that goes really well, and they realize, oh, I get a really high response from this growing segment of my audience, which may become the majority of your audience very quickly, who want me to talk about this thing. And this is what is called audience capture, where you are literally almost dictated what you create in order to make your existing audience happy. Yeah. And that can be really challenging. Like, we see this in politics all the time. People that are creating political content on any platform, they realize the more sensational they go in one direction, it attracts the most polarized, sensational people from that corner. Mm-hmm. And they're incentivized to keep pandering to that corner. And it really puts you in a bind. So I'm personally not interested in doing sensational things. And virality, though nice, comes with challenges. But I am personally much more interested in creating a loyal following, even if that takes a long time, and actively fighting against audience capture.
Well, we had that conversation, too, after the Jenny video, is like, do we make more shorts content right away? Because obviously in long term, of course, we're going to make another video on shorts. They're just kind of the nature of like educational content. But we made a decision after talking through it, like we don't want to be a shorts content channel. So it's like we might take a hit in the next couple of videos because this new audience is super interested in shorts content. And we're okay with that because that's the decision we made with our channel. And I think the other thing is the two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive in terms of like Dodford in our interview with Dodford, Danny says something along the lines of you only need two huge hits per year to continue to grow your channel, which there's a lot of truth to that in terms of like one viral video isn't going to set your channel up for success. You have to be consistent with it. And what you're looking for is a general trend of upward growth. Yeah, maybe our views this month aren't going to be as high as they were the 2 months after the Jenny episode came out, but it's a general trend upward and we're raising our base level of views. And that's kind of what you're looking for, where you want to take shots for views, but not every video is going to be that massive hit, especially depending on your niche. If you're making educational content, that's just like the given.
Yeah, not all attention is created equal. Attention does not mean affinity, and attention does not mean trust. So I'm extremely entrepreneurial minded, and I recognized a long time ago that you can only build a business if you have people who trust you and therefore mm-hmm. want to buy from you. And so I'm not interested in just shallow attention for the sake of big numbers. My path to building a lifestyle and a business is through affinity and trust, people who know, like, and trust you from your content. And so it's really easy to kind of trend jack and get in front of new people and get attention, quote unquote. But if what you're creating doesn't actually build likability or trust with the people that it's reaching, to me, it like doesn't really serve a point. And in fact, it can actually play against you sometimes yeah. because followers who don't actually care about your content, if they're served your content and don't interact with it, it's kind of a weight bringing you down on any platform.
And there's the personal side of that too, where it's like, if you don't like that content, then you're not going to be able to sustain. Because if totally. You're just taking shots for these big views and you're not actually enjoying the content, if it's not hitting the purpose you want to go out, that's not going to be sustainable.
Totally. A lot of times a good litmus test is, if this thing goes viral, would I be comfortable making a lot more of this for a long time? Mm-hmm. And if your personal interest is like, no, I don't want to make more of this, then you shouldn't publish it probably. Because like a best case scenario is that it reaches people and they like it. But if that creates this albatross around your neck, weighing you down from doing the things that you want to do, that's not a good place to be as a creator.
Neptune Design asks, when you do your intros, which I love, by the way, how do you know what to include and exclude? Like, the problem I'm having is there's always a really good 80-second chunk of the convo I want to use for the intro, but it's too long. This question is related to podcast intros.
Well, I'll kick this one off, but a lot of this goes to Connor's design on the video channel. When this was just an audio podcast, and if you don't subscribe to the Creator Science audio podcast, you should. When this was just an audio podcast, the way I thought about it was that I kind of thought about the show in three acts, even though I didn't really even name it that in my mind. I actually think, Connor, you're the one that helped me think of the term act for those things. Mm-hmm. But I basically thought about the show in three parts. And what I wanted to do in the intro was give an arc of the whole conversation, a preview of the arc of the whole conversation. And so typically I would pull a little bit of audio from the first, second, and third of the episode to kind of paint a picture of what the episode will cover in the beginning. And honestly, it got to a point where I was hearing a psychologist talk about this, and he didn't give a name to it. But when you're a creative person, there's this feeling of things just kind of like clicking into place. It's like putting two puzzle pieces together. When you have like an aesthetic or a style or some sort of sensibility, you start to just sense when puzzle pieces click. And when I would edit the audio show, I would come across something in the edit that would just have that click feeling of, that's an engaging little bit of audio that I want to pull into the intro. And I would just cut it and move to the intro, which I would deal with later. And there are some very technical things like I realized something longer than 12 seconds usually is too much of one consecutive audio bit. Or this really needs to end on a high note, and it kind of streams off. But Connor, how do you think about that on the video channel?
Pretty similar. I'll get into some of the like technical details about what I'm actually doing. So the first thing we should start out with is every one of our episodes has a very specific purpose. Like there is something that we want our audience to take away from the guest coming on. So no matter what, that's going to guide the entire episode, from the prep, from the packaging, from a lot of times who we even have on. Because a lot of times we will have guests based around what they know versus who they are. So look at everything I'm saying through that lens, that every quote, whatever I'm writing in the intro has to advance that point.
And let me double down on that real quick. What Connor is saying is we've basically decided on at least a rough idea of a package before we even reach out to the guest. So that has guided the entire conversation that is prepped and recorded by the time we get into the edit to think about the intro.
So with that being said, when I'm going through and listening to the episode for the first time, I mark down every single quote that I think could even have the slightest chance of making it in the intro to make it easier for me. So there will be like anywhere from 10 to 25 or 30 quotes that are marked in my timeline that obviously most of them aren't going to, you know, work out or I'm not going to like later, but I have them there to be saved. And what I'm looking for when I'm doing these quotes is, did they say something that gives them credibility or results to back up whatever they're saying? Because in the intro, we're going to have to sell them, right? Because a lot of the times we'll have guests on that you might not know because they're not massive creators or they work behind other creators. So we have to have some sort of results. So I'll pull those out. Service level value gives. So anytime they can give some sort of information, but we don't want it to be too in-depth. We want to save that for the later in the episode. And that's not a retention, oh, we're going to hold it thing. It's a, you don't want to dive too deep in the intro because that's not what people want. Like in the intro, it's to bring you in and to kind of glaze over something, not to dive into a lesson right away. Kind of like a syllabus week type thing where it's like, we're looking at the syllabus right now. We're not getting to the class just yet. We're just doing the overview. Third one would be cliffhangers or open loops. Are there sentences where the guest is listing something where, you know, whether it's a bleep or I can end it on a cliffhanger that opens a loop for the audience to be like, oh, that's interesting. I want to hear more about that. Or, oh, what is the end of what he's saying there? And then the last one would be contradiction. Like, for example, the Dr. K intro.
There's a lot of common wisdom about content creation that I'm convinced is like pretty wrong. And now I feel pretty confident about this because we've had 500 creators go through our program and like the results are astronomical.
So that's the hook quote, which you don't have to start out with a hook quote. I'll talk about that in a second. But there's a lot of common wisdom about content creation that I'm convinced is like pretty wrong. So right off the bat, if you're looking at this video from a new viewer standpoint, you clicked on the video that has the title, what is it? Harvard Psychiatrist, Meet the Harvard Psychiatrist That's Getting YouTubers Millions of Views. So if you click on this video, you hear that this dude is a Harvard psychiatrist, and he's saying that a lot of the common content creation wisdom that you probably know is wrong. Contradiction. So I'm going to pull that like hands down. So that's an example of that.
Provocative. And something implicit that you're saying there is like, when people click the video on the homepage or some recommended area, which is where the majority of our views come from, they have a belief about what that video is going to be, but they still probably need to be convinced that this is a video worth watching or that their belief was correct. So a lot of the intro is backing up what we've set up with that package, the title, the thumbnail, the idea as a whole.
Yep, exactly. You have to reaffirm the click because within like the first 30 seconds, the audience should know what the entire video is about. So that being said, so that's how I mark quotes down. So from there, I'll have, you know, anywhere from 10 to 30 quotes. Then I'll go through and list the flow and topics of the entire episode, everything that is talked about before it gets cut. out of those topics, I decide what's going to actually make the episode, because usually around 25 to 40% of the interviews get cut down. The interviews are much longer than what you see on the channel. And then I look at what of these that make the episode, which of these topics that make the episode are most interesting to the audience through the lens of the goal of this episode. Because a lot of times there's topics that could be interesting in another episode, but they don't really fit this topic. Which of those topics have really good quotes that I marked out? So I'll have them marked out and being like, okay, there's 7 of these topics that are really good, but only 3 of them have like really good, nice, hardline quotes. That's what's going to make the intro, because that's really the important part, is to get that brief overview of something that's going to hook the viewer. And if there aren't very many good hard quotes, because that depends a lot on the speaker and how they talk and how they deliver information, as an editor, I'll ask, can I make a good quote by piecing different things together? The ethics of this is obviously you never want to make the guest say something that is different, has a different intention than what they laid out. And really what you're only doing when you're editing their words is to help them get their point across better than like in a normal episode. For example, in the Thomas Frank, in the last Thomas Frank episode we did, I forget the title of that, the Hidden Opportunity in Tutorial Channels, I believe. The very first line Thomas says is,
I wanted to create a destination that people immediately thought of as the go-to place to learn Notion. I want to make software tutorials so good-looking that people are like, why would he put this much effort into it? This is stupid.
Those two sentences are from different parts of the interview. Like there's, you know, whatever, a couple minutes in between them. But when I'm going through and looking at quotes, I saw that those go well together and they complement each other. So I'm going to put those together in the intro, even though they don't appear next to each other later on in the episode.
Yeah, there's this delicate balance with interviews where the intro really supports somebody's choice of tuning in for like a 30 to 60 minute thing. That's kind of what we're trying to do. We could talk about the conversation we had with Patty Galloway a few months back, but really what we're trying to do is get people to commit to what is a longer than typical YouTube video to watch. And the intro is there to reaffirm the click, as Connor said, and also set up like, why should you care what this person says? My biggest pet peeve, especially in audio, is when the beginning of an interview starts and the host asks the guest to introduce themselves, because they're going to be either like super self-conscious or they're humble, or maybe they go way too long and like, here's everything I've done in my 20-year career. Our job as hosts is to key that person up, to set them up, to say, this is why we brought them on the channel and why you should care too. Do that as quickly and as compelling as possible to encourage you to watch the rest of the video.
So we have all of that. Now we choose which quotes we use, right? So in our format, we do 4 body quotes, and that's basically in this episode, you'll learn. And it's only 4. That was carried over from legacy of what we did in audio. We just kept doing 4. There's no real reason. It's like, you have to have 4. So I know I have to have 4 quotes that are going to line up with the 4 topics that are most sellable and best quotes. Generally, we usually start with a hook, but you don't have to start with a hook quote. For that Thomas example, I felt the episode was more sellable if we set up. And when I say more sellable, I mean like more hooky. That's generally the term I use, because there's a lot of different ways you can say that. But it's easier to sell an idea that Thomas abandoned his 2 million subscriber YouTube channel than with a quote about tutorial channels. That just kind of paints the picture better and brings the audience in better. So in that one, I started out with just Jay's VO, and I wrote,
2 years ago, Thomas Frank made the seemingly crazy decision to abandon his 2 million subscriber YouTube channel that he spent a decade of his life building to make software tutorials.
And then I backed that up with a quote. And that quote doesn't have to be as big of a hook, because I already set up the point that he abandoned his YouTube channel to do something else, which is why we're drawing people in, not the quote itself. If you do use a quote, there's a couple guidelines that I have. It has to be like what I call a sucker punch quote, meaning no buildup. It has to exist on its own with zero context, no buildup, no anything. It has to hit the guests, or it has to hit the audience right away. And you want it to back up the packaging or the through line of the episode. Like what Jay said, is to reaffirm the click. I think a very good example of this is our interview with Patty Galloway. There's three really, really good interviews that I've seen with Patty Galloway. One is on the editing podcast. One was on John Yushai's podcast, and then ours. It's all of the same guest, but within the first 30 seconds, you can tell how each one is different. So with ours, it's about, we're talking to Patty about ideation. So what we start our quote or our episode out with is,
I can't say it enough. Like, I'd be blue in the face saying this until I think the day I die, is like, the idea is more important than everything.
First sentence, you know that this episode is going to be about ideas. If you go to John's channel, you see him talk about more of the spectacle of working with Mr. Beast in a more like, I don't know if well-rounded is the right word, but a broader type of spectacle interview. And in the editing podcast interview, it's very clear that they're talking about editing. So that's like the importance of the hook is ours reaffirms the reason why someone clicked on our video and what they're going to learn. And what the editing podcast did and John did with their intros is the exact same thing, but geared toward what their episode is about.
If you know me, you know how much I believe in memberships. My membership is the core of my business, and earning an income directly from your audience is one of the most sustainable ways for you to become a professional creator too. So I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Uscreen. Uscreen is a beautiful all-in-one platform that helps content creators earn a living from their videos by unlocking predictable, recurring revenue. You can host private live streams for your members, build an on-demand catalog of premium content, and Uscreen gives you a community hub to interact with your members too. They can access your community from their mobile phone, so your membership is right there in their pocket. With a Uscreen account, you get video hosting, an out-of-the-box website, full payment and subscription management, and plenty of third-party integrations too. And Uscreen makes it easy to get set up. You get access to powerful website themes that are fully brandable with no coding skills required. Uscreen will even provide a dedicated success manager for you. Just about anyone that wants to make money from their content can do it with Uscreen. It's perfect for coaches, authors, influencers, and entrepreneurs in just about any niche. Right now, Uscreen is used by creators in fitness, education, news, kids entertainment, and more. That includes Yoga with Adrian and Creator Now, just to name a couple. Uscreen is the platform for building a video membership site that is great for generating a sustainable income for professional creators. If you create video content for your audience, I highly recommend checking it out. If you're interested in learning more about Uscreen, visit uscreen.link/J. That's uscreen.link/J, and let them know that I sent you. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Last year, my wife and I started talking about her joining the business full time. This is a huge decision, not just for the business, but for our marriage. My wife, being the very smart and thoughtful woman that she is, suggested that we proactively sign up for therapy as a couple to help us communicate better before we started working together. It really helped us have better language to describe how we're feeling and listen to one another, which generally lowers the intensity of any conversation. Now, I had never been in therapy before, but here's something that I didn't expect. It didn't just help our dialogue, but it helped my inner monologue too. The way I understand my own experience has changed based on the tools that I got from therapy. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, it fits your schedule, and you can be in the comfort of your own home. Just fill out a short questionnaire and you'll get matched with a licensed therapist. They even make it easy to switch therapists if it doesn't feel like a fit. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/creator today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/creator.
Mark Keeps God First asks, "Hey Jay and Connor, I've experimented with a few different types of video styles, fully scripted videos with some editing and text on screen, bullet point scripts and minimal cuts, and just raw videos of me talking directly to the camera. My audience seems to resonate with me the most when there are zero edits involved. So my question is there now a niche for raw, unedited content amongst the noise of overstimulating content? Is my unfair advantage my authenticity, or should I try to level up my content production? Because the better the production quality, the less authentic it seems. What are your thoughts, Jay?
This is a super common question right now. This is the Sam Sulek question.
And Kevin from Epic Gardening, too. He started a channel like that and has seen some success.
Yeah. So my take on this, and Connor, I'm interested to hear your opinion, is I think what we see from channels that are doing this well, or what Mark might be experiencing, is when you kind of go off the cuff, usually it's coming from like an emotional place where you have something to say that you feel strongly about. And I think that is what's resonating with the audience, not just the format of it. I think it's the fact that you have a strong opinion, you aren't doing this as like a performative thing, you're just sharing what you think. And I think that kind of content tends to do well. But you could wrap that into higher production and it would still do well. I think it's an emotional resonance question more than people sitting around saying, I just wish videos had less editing.
Yeah. And I think there's intentionality behind it, that people also kind of think like being authentic means you're not being intentional about what you're saying, as if like, you know, Kevin or Sam or any of those guys will sit down and just not have a plan before they talk at all, which could be the case. And if that is, then they could just be really good at speaking off the cuff and things like that. Not everybody's like that. So I think being intentional doesn't mean amazing lights or amazing camera quality. I think a really cool example of this is what a lot of live streamers do, where it's like they might not have the best equipment because that's like the vibe they want to give off. There's an example, OTK Productions is a content organization. They'll do a lot of IRL live streaming content where they use really, really nice gear, but it doesn't, you wouldn't know that they're using like cinema cameras because you're not supposed to. It's supposed to get that feel, but they're still being intentional about how they do things. So it's like, if you're outlining or doing anything like that, be intentional about it. You don't have to just sit down and speak whatever, because a lot of times it's going to be a little jumbled.
Yeah. If I sat down and just did something straight off the cuff with no prep at all, 9 times out of 10, it would probably be obvious that I did no prep.
Yep.
And haven't thought about this before. And people wouldn't watch just because it's off the cuff. They would probably say, what am I even watching here? So a lot of people seeing the success of Sam Sulek or people like him need to be careful in assuming that the format or the stripped down nature of it is what makes it successful. I think it's much more likely that it's the person, the personality, the emotion, the intentionality and planning they've already done in their head before they start delivering to camera.
Yeah. And Mark, looking at your channel, you have 381 subscribers, two videos over a thousand views. So it's like clearly you found something that resonated with some people, but it's also a very small data set. Even when we were starting this channel, we had to be careful about what you're listening to and attributing reasons for that, because it's such a small data size. And it's like your audience right now at 381 subscribers could look very different at 10,000 subscribers, at 50,000 subscribers, as you kind of find out the broader interest of that person you're trying to connect with.
That being said, whatever size you're at, if you're getting some sort of signal that something might be working better than something else, play with it. Keep experimenting, keep trying it. And yep, you'll get more data and you can continue to make decisions based on the amount of data you're getting in.
Valentin Farkash asks, do you have any standard operating procedures or systems in place to enable the consistent output? In particular, I'd love to hear how you manage outreach to guests and the production flow from there to a finished episode.
100% I do. And I don't know that I would survive without it.
Yeah.
And the formats change a lot over time. So like in the beginning, when it was just me and it was just one platform, I was doing everything in like a Trello board. No one talks about Trello anymore since they got acquired, but Trello was like an early Kanban board. It looks a little bit like Asana. Yep. You can do something similar in Notion and Airtable. But I would just move things from like idea to pitched, in progress, done. And I could manage things in that view. Things have gotten more complicated as we've published now on We publish an email newsletter twice per month. We publish the podcast once per week. We publish the YouTube channel once or twice per month. And so there's just a lot of stuff in flight at any given time. And I really try to get ahead of the raw materials of publishing. So like on our channel, that's the recorded interviews themselves. So now all of this lives in Notion. Over the last couple of years, I've put a lot of time and work into making Notion work for me, because Notion is like this beautiful sandbox and playground, but it's really up to you to make it work for you. And so it's been a lot of iteration. Now it's in a place where I collaborate with Connor in there. I collaborate with our audio engineer, my wife, my assistant. We've had other third parties that are in there for one reason or another. It's all inside of Notion in a content database.
Man, it'd be so nice if that was a template that other people could download.
Yes. So that is what I've been working on for the last couple of months, is taking my setup, which works, but was a little bit like rough. Like it was very utilitarian, but a little messy. Mm-hmm. So I cleaned that up. I pulled it all into like this very well-packaged setup that now completely mirrors my setup. And I've productized this. It's called Creator HQ. It is available for sale starting April 11th.
April 11th.
Yeah. Depending on when you watch this video, the link will be in the comments to either join the presale or get it now. But this is literally our system at Creator Science.
Yep.
You can get that template, implement it. And what I really tried to do in this template was go over and above in terms of education and training on how to use it. Because again, Notion is like a sandbox. You can make whatever you want out of it. But a lot of people buy Notion templates, they don't know how to use it, and it just sits on the shelf. So this has tutorials built into it. It has little tool tips and info blocks all over it. So you can know exactly how this works.
And I will say, I like using this one a lot more than our old one. Our old one kind of intimidated me. This one looks way better and is super clean.
Yeah. So if you want to use what we use, including literally like the step-by-step pre-production of these videos and how we think about that, that's all built into the template too. But without Notion, I would not be able to manage all these things. And it helps me manage sponsorship. It helps me manage my tasks. It's where I keep all of my notes. I even have like a personal dashboard. So we have like grocery lists and the stuff I've got to prepare for my sister's wedding. Like all of this is in one place and we've built it for you.
And just to go through production flow, to get specific, if this person was curious about that, basically from start to finish, we do the ideation, which the single biggest change we've made in the show since we started was moving so much emphasis to pre-production. So that's where a lot of it happens, where we're thinking about ideas, topics, matching those to people. And then basically that'll get sent out to Jay. We're like, okay, we want to reach out to these people. Let's say this person that we reached out to says yes. Then I go through and I'll do some initial prep from the packaging ideas of like, for example, the John Yushai episode. We knew from the very beginning, we wanted that interview to be an expansion of one of his YouTube videos. So in the doc, I put in his YouTube video, said, these are interesting points. Let's see if he can expand on those. And then it goes from there. Jay does the interview. Then afterwards, it gets uploaded to Dropbox, where it gets an initial mix from our audio engineer. I start the edit after that mix. I write the intro script for Jay. Then that gets sent off to Jay. While he is recording that, I do cut and graphics. And then after that, intro edit. Engineer gets the final mix. I get revisions on graphics, final export, quality check, chapters, ad placements, and then we upload. And that's all tracked out through the Notion and Dropbox, I guess, is important in that too.
Yeah. And that's alongside all the things like sponsor communications. It also happens in Notion to say, this is related to this video or this newsletter issue, which I'm also writing in Notion. So it's all in there.
Millennial Meg asks, I'm a brand new channel, less than 3 months, but I have 2,000 watch hours and 300 subs because I've accidentally found success with decluttering videos. I want to keep decluttering, but I don't want to get stuck there. I want to be able to do more general, improve your life overall type content. is it better to just focus on my small niche and improve there so I can count on the views? Or is now the time to experiment and try everything I want, but probably sacrifice views and growth for a while? What do you think?
I think there's some embedded limited beliefs in this question. The idea that experimenting right now will come at a sacrifice of views and growth, I think is not true. I think that might be true at some level of scale, but I think that's much more likely to be true when the channel is much larger and much more mature. I actually think it would be just as easy right now for you, Meg, to have a video about some other general life improvement concept that does better than your decluttering videos and actually could double the channel overnight. I think that's very possible at the scale that you're at right now. So I think it's good that you're asking the question of what do I want this channel to be and being intentional about that. And I think this is a perfectly fine time to continue to make choices in terms of what videos you're making that are aligned with what you ultimately want the channel to be. What do you think, Connor?
Yeah, I'm going to lump. There was another question from Farm Traveler that's similar along the lines. They asked, what are some tips when you want to dramatically pivot your content, still serving the same purpose and subject matter, but with a very new and different format style? So very, you ask the same questions in different ways. And I think like what Farm Traveler said is when you want to dramatically pivot your content is really important there, because a lot of people will say like, oh, I have to pivot this content. Like what you're saying is, oh, I want to do this other stuff, where it's like, okay, I did this one thing, now I do this other thing and I have to do it forever, which isn't the case with YouTube, especially with small channels. Like you can work things in slowly. You can continue to change things. Like this show is so much different than our first video we did. And that's because we like kept iterating on things, introducing new things. And there was never a moment where like, oh, we did this, now we do that. It's a growth from trying different things and iterating and figuring out what works. So I looked at Meg's channel and she's posting, I don't know, 2-3 times a week. So you're talking 8 videos a month, do 6 normal videos and 2 experiments, or, you know, it's things like that where you're breaking down what you're doing into content buckets. We're saying, okay, I know that this style is working right now, and I think there's this other thing that my audience might like, and just start trying to introduce that. And in our interview with John Yushai, he talks about content buckets a lot, about marrying your niche and varying your format, which is how he says it, to introduce new things and then iterate on it at least 5 times. Don't try the same thing 5 times in a row, but if you want to introduce this other idea or new format, try it out. And if it felt good, or if even if it didn't feel good, try to improve it the next time and start to work those things in slowly rather than all at once, because that's where people kind of mess up, because that shocks an audience. What are you at? You're at 452 subscribers. You have a couple videos, over 2,000 views, 1,000 views, which is really, really good. You've clearly found something. Just keep building on that. Like it's still a very, very small channel. You still have a ton of room to grow. Don't feel boxed in by what got you your first 100 or 1,000 or tens of thousands subscribers. Because at the end of the day, if you want your channel to be big, this is such a small drop of who your audience is and who's watching your videos right now.
Yeah, that's the point I want to double click on, is there is so many viewers and so much viewing attention out there that what you have now is great. It's a signal of what you're building, but you could completely move in a different direction from here. I'm not saying to do that. I'm just saying there's so much potential still with the channel and what you're doing. A lot of people look at things as like this fork in the road, left or right decision when they want to make changes, but it's more like a little diversion that you can test. And if it doesn't go well, or if you don't like it, or if other people don't like it, then you can course correct just a little bit and it's fine. I love the advice of, if you're doing 8 videos a month, try 2 videos that are in a different format or a slightly different topic, because that is such a low cost, potential high reward test. And that's what you want to look for. You want to look for these asymmetric tests where the downside is low and the upside is high. And you have lots of opportunity to do that.
And hitting upon the second part of that question on like tips on how to do it or like change formats or things like that. Really good example. I think we've talked about in like the episode with Jamie Rossthorne, Patty, and maybe even Ed is looking at what did well in other niches and then formatting it that way. So like you could use a tool like Jake Thomas's Creator Hooks, where I'm sure he won't mind me showing. I'll pull this up, where it shows you successful titles and thumbnails of other videos and stats about them and gives you formats. So you can start to see, okay, this format, this weird title in a golf niche is interesting and that worked. How can I do this for decluttering? What does it look like to do a challenge video for decluttering? What does it look like to do an experiment for that decluttering or whatever Farm Travelers content is? What does it look like to do contradictions in this niche and sort of sort through those and start to introduce them? Because I think a lot of things that people go into would be like, oh, I do decluttering. That's the, I can only talk about decluttering, when it's like, that's not quite right. You can do all of these other formats and add action to it and add stakes to it or add story to it all around the same topic that still allows you to branch out and bring people in. That especially they get to see you, because I think at the end of the day, that's kind of where you want your content to go. If you're saying you want to introduce more, improve your life overall stuff, which generally requires a connection with your audience. So introducing those different sides and seeing you more active and things like that could be really, really beneficial.
Yes.
Tanmay Bahavar asks, sorry about the pronunciation, in a world saturated with content, how can creators ensure that their work stands out and reaches its intended audience, aside from showing your personality?
Well, the first thing I would do is pull out my Dr. K hat and say, you can't ensure anything.
Good call.
I think about that a lot now, because I do. I mean, at first when I was having that conversation with him, I'm like, are you challenging the entire premise of my entire business? but I think it's good to keep in mind that you can't ensure anything. All you can do is try to improve your odds and create the circumstances where the outcome you want is more likely than not. So in terms of how can we make it more likely that our work stands out and reaches our intended audience? First of all, I like the second part of the question. How do we make sure it reaches our intended audience? It has to be useful or helpful or enjoyable to that intended audience. Everything that you create has to be speaking to that person and what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So that's like a litmus test you constantly need to be running. If you are your own audience, then you can kind of test it on yourself, but you can also look at this through the eyes of the feedback that you're getting. Is this resonating with people? This goes back to like the signal of progress idea. Am I getting some sign that this is resonating in the way that I was hoping with the person I was hoping that it would?
Yeah. And being like super clear and writing that goal down of, let's say in YouTube standards, being like, for this video, when the viewers are done watching, this is the experience I want them to have had, or this is the action I want them to take. And viewing the entirety of that piece of content through that lens, does it accomplish that?
One thing I do in email, if you're writing a newsletter, that helps us a lot is when somebody signs up for my newsletter, the first email they get confirming their subscription says, what's going on in your world that led you to sign up for this list? Mm. And it's this really tight feedback loop, because the answers to that question tell me if I'm reaching the right people or setting the right expectations. And there have been times when that has not been true. And so if I'm reaching the wrong person, then I need to look at, how did this person find it? And why did they find it? Or if it's the right person, but they seem to be asking for something that I don't provide, why do they have the expectation that I could provide that? So having tight feedback loops in some way, maybe you see it in the comments that you're getting, or maybe you see it in the headline of the person who is commenting that they're the right person for you or the wrong person for you. You've got to be calibrating and saying, am I getting in front of the right people? Because if not, you got to change the system. Whatever you're doing right now is getting the wrong results. So you need to change something to get the right results. Maybe it's where you're showing up. Maybe it's the subject matter you're writing about. You need to make sure that right now, the people who are seeing your stuff, which it might not be as many as you want, but the people who are seeing it, are they the right people? And you got to be intellectually honest with yourself. If it's not right, you've got to change something about what you're doing to make that more likely to be true. Now, standing out.
I think standing out is the hard part. From a YouTube perspective, I can't speak to like Twitter or LinkedIn or anything. It almost exclusively comes down to the idea and the packaging. And I think a really, really cool example of this, of how important it is this. There's a French dance music group called Jersey, and they released an EP on YouTube with a video titled "We Play Music Until Someone Breaks Our Synths." Now, this is titled like you would think a normal challenge video, where it'd be like, okay, this is going to be a storytelling video. It's literally just an EDM set. It's really good. It's a really good EDM set. If you like it, check it out. But all they did was make a good thumbnail, which they changed, by the way. There's two versions of the thumbnail. So they were clearly did this with performance in mind. And the other thing is just adding that little twist where it's like at the end of their, when they're done playing their EP, one of their friends comes over and pushes their synth over. And it's like, all they did was play music, but it's this view. It has now almost 480,000 views, by far the most viewed video on their channel outside of just like normal, or not even outside. They just post normal music beforehand. But it's like, that's the power of it, where it's just a music set. How did it stand out? They packaged it really, really well.
Yeah, the answer to this question is in the question itself. Like, if you think about the idea of standing out, it means this is different.
Yeah.
So to ensure that your work stands out, you have to do something differently. And what I see a lot of creators fall in the trap of is they look at who is finding success. Let me mimic what they are doing. And that is by definition derivative of someone else's work. So you can take that and twist it and make it different in some way. And that's going to give you the best shot, because to stand out, you have to be different. And to be different requires creative risks. A lot of times the effort of standing out will have the outcome of nothing. Like that's just the game. A lot of times you try things that are different and it doesn't work. It just misses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the only way to ensure that you can stand out is to ensure that your work is genuinely different in some way, and recognize that there are risks and downsides to doing that, but you have to be okay with it.
And I think the undervalued or often overlooked aspect of this is like, you can get better at this from research of doing things like this, where it's like, oh, I'm looking for outlier videos. And it's like, oh, this is an interesting idea of, let's take the Jersey music example of like, okay, this is interesting. What if in my gardening content, I introduced something like that? I don't know what it would look like grow whatever until blank, but it's like, it's a similar concept applied to a different niche that you can put your own spin on. Now you have a unique idea that you can package well, you've seen it worked, and go through things like, again, Jake Thomas's Creator Hooks Pro, where you see other outlier videos that worked, and analyzing, being like, okay, this is really, really interesting. Could I take something about this, whether it's a title format or a thumbnail format, and kind of create this new experience from this interesting thing?
This episode is sponsored by Podcast Movement. For the past decade, Podcast Movement has organized the world's largest gathering of podcasters, featuring thousands of attendees, hundreds of breakout sessions, panels, and workshops, plus the largest trade show in podcasting. Podcast Movement helps podcasters of all experience levels create, grow, and profit from their show. It's suitable for beginners, but you'll also have the opportunity to meet some of the biggest names in the industry. I've been to several Podcast Movement events, and not only is the programming incredible, but the culture and vibe are incredible too. It attracts thoughtful, empathetic, and collaborative people, which makes sense when you think about the medium of podcasting. Podcast Movement hosts two events per year. The first just wrapped up, but their flagship conference is happening August 19th through the 22nd in Washington, D.C. Attendees have the freedom to choose their own adventure across several different stages throughout the four-day event, not to mention dozens of amazing networking events, parties, and the expo hall floor. Tracks include podcast creation, video and live streaming, industry professional,
plus several stages of curated programming from some of the top companies in podcasting. It's truly a unique event, and if you are a podcaster, I cannot recommend it enough. Right now, tickets are available at super duper early bird pricing. And as a Creator Science listener, you can save $50 on top of that by visiting podcastmovement.com/science. That's podcastmovement.com/science.
Dennis Geelan asks, what's your top strategy for creating YouTube videos that drive engagement? What do you think?
It's an interesting question. I don't even think about engagement on YouTube the way I think about engagement everywhere else. What's always been like so awesome about YouTube as a platform is there is this built-in culture of commenting that's stronger than like any other platform. It's crazy just how many people spend time commenting on YouTube videos. So that feels good. If you're talking about engagement in terms of I keep watching the videos, then I think it's like momentum, or you'd probably call it pacing. George Blackman talks about signposting in our video together. You kind of have to think about the video as this journey that has a distinct beginning, middle, and end that people feel like they're progressing towards so that they keep paying attention, which becomes more challenging in like long form interviews than your typical YouTube video. But I really do think that you need structure that the person watching has a sense of what are we working towards, and at any given moment, they feel satisfied that they're progressing towards it. Sounds very theoretical. How would you say that?
I completely agree. And I think some of it comes down to overarching relatability or like topic choosing. Because it's like you can do all of those things, but if it's a topic your audience really doesn't care about, then it's not going to be engaging. So I think on like a mechanical level, that would be things like doing research about what does your audience actually care about? Like, what are those specific questions? What do they need to hear? What do they want to hear? And how can you relate that information in a way that resonates with them, that like sounds like it's coming from someone that they would trust? Because it's like at the end of the day, we can be technical about editing or anything like that, but it comes down to the idea and how you're relating that to the audience, which is mostly done by research and engaging with your audience yourself.
I even struggle with the phrase your audience, quote unquote, on YouTube, because you kind of have to think about like your target audience, your audience avatar, because subscribers aren't what you think they are if you're new to YouTube. Subscribers are people who have watched a video and have said, I would be happy considering more videos from this person. And really, even as our subscriber base has grown, the majority of our views, video to video, are non-subscribers. So you have to think about what am I making for my intended audience? What are their problems? Not just what do my subscribers want? And so the reason I bring that up is most of your video viewers have not found your channel yet, is what I would say. They don't actually know who you are yet. So if you're going to attract them, your face on a thumbnail probably isn't going to be the thing that attracts them. It's probably going to be like a specific idea that's related to a problem they're facing that they didn't even know you exist or you talk about yet, or some interest they have.
Yeah. And even in terms of how you're getting in front of them, I can speak from my user experience as someone who's like been a YouTube user for, I don't know, 15 years, and from our channel stats. Even people who are subscribed are mostly watching from browse features of like the homepage and getting suggested. So it's not even like when you're talking about your audience, it's not people that are like using your sub box or using their sub box or community tab. Because it's more like if I sub, it's more of a signal to the algorithm like, hey, show me their next video on my homepage. So it's like I don't use my subscriptions tab anymore, which is considerably different than how I used YouTube 5 or 6 years ago. And that's just how good their algorithm's gotten.
Last thing I'll say, Dennis, is just structure, like prep and planning and really thinking about what is the journey I'm taking somebody on, because since the viewer probably doesn't know you yet, they're not going to have a lot of patience for you.
Yes.
You have to really earn their trust every second of the way in the video.
Baldly Rudy asks, I'm an up-and-coming tech content creator and have a lot of inbound emails. Some of it is from no-name brands and others are legitimate offers, but I'm getting overwhelmed with keeping the momentum of the channel and dealing with brands for deals. When is a good indication for a growing content creator to get representation of some kind for brand deals? This is a good one. I think overarching answer is, depending on who you ask, never. Yes. With Justin Moore.
I was going to say that too. But we've also worked with people who do a good job of representation. So it's hard. It's really a case by case. And I've worked with representation on the audio show, in my newsletter. So I've done both sides of things. And there are clear costs of overhead of managing this yourself, as you're experiencing right now, it sounds like, Rudy, with just managing this, the thoughts on your mind of, oh, I've got to respond to them, or how am I going to do this? That's taking away from creative energy. There's no denial of that here. What I've come to realize is it's better to take twice as much time to deal with partners who will do two times as large of campaigns than try to work with more people at a smaller scale, because there's a certain level of overhead that happens with every partnership, no matter the size, and the efficiencies come from doing fewer campaigns. And also, something that I'm thinking about a lot right now is just alignment and even what a soft endorsement of a partnership is. Integrity and making sure that you're aligned with the sponsor, I think, is like the most long-term important thing you can do with these partnerships. And so if you're getting brand deals in that feel illegitimate or like it might not be worth your time or you don't feel totally aligned with, I would just trust your gut and pass on it and not think about it again.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the skill, is learning how quickly can I rule certain things out and just be at peace with not thinking about that ever again, and really try to attract and only work with the absolute best possible sponsors and give them a great experience. This is the other thing that I realized when I was working with representation, was sometimes I was not in control of the partner experience, and that partner might not be having a great experience with that representation, or might not feel as cared for or looked after. So, you know, even if you do want to go down the representation route, you've got to do your own work of vetting that person and making sure that the processes make sense. So, you know, ask yourself, do you want to build the capabilities of managing partnerships in-house? And that might be you in the immediate term. It might be a contractor. It might be someone on commission. Or do you want to outsource this? And if you want to outsource it quickly. If you want to do it in-house, build some processes to make this better. And we have a related question from Jay Akunzo about this also that we'll talk about here in a second.
Jay's question is, if you were starting from scratch with sponsorships, what would you do differently, or what would you set up so it runs smoother?
So the nice thing about having representation to Rudy's question, the nice thing about having a representation to Rudy's question is that it saves you all that time overhead, but it usually comes at the expense of like 20 to 40% of the revenue, which is significant as you grow. So to Jay's question, I am starting from scratch with sponsorships. And what I'm doing differently is realizing it's an experience that I want to bring in-house. And instead of having what I used to think of as just like inventory and these different platforms, you know, we have one integration per YouTube video, and we have this many mid-rolls and this many pre-rolls in the podcast, and we have this many presenting sponsors in the newsletter. I used to look at every discrete possible ad unit as inventory, and I felt pain if I didn't fill that with some sort of sponsor. And So even at times in the past, I've like discounted rates to make sure that I'm getting something for that ad unit. What I'm realizing now is, again, it's better to work with fewer partners that are super well aligned, that you trust, you believe in, and also maybe bigger campaigns. You know, I'm letting newsletters fly now without ads, because I'm realizing, heck, I can use my own ad space and get the same financial benefit a lot of the time. So if I don't fill that space, I'm not going to stress over it. I would rather continue to focus on just the best partners possible and have less administrative overhead and conversations. Because every sponsorship conversation I have usually starts with an inbound email if I'm not pitching. They'll send an inbound email, say I'm interested. They give me a little bit of data. We schedule a call. We work through a set of questions I have to learn their campaign goals, the best partnerships they've had in the past, their budget, what their product priorities are right now. Then I take that information and make a custom proposal with three different packages at three different levels of investment. I send them that proposal. They look at it. Sometimes we negotiate, sometimes we don't. Then I have to choose dates and integrations. I have to get creative guidelines from them, like a creative brief. Then I put that brief into actual creative, whether it's audio, video, or written. Then it flies. Then I report on it. So you can see all these steps. There's a lot here. It's better to work with fewer sponsors so that you just spend less time doing that. And I've basically made that whole process step by step in Notion so that I keep track of it without thinking about it. And I can view multiple campaigns in flight.
And I think the biggest thing, I don't handle much of the ads, but like listening to Justin Moore talk so much, who, if you haven't watched those episodes, we've done two episodes with him on sponsorships. You should definitely check them out. But the reframing of thinking about brand deals as from transactions to relationships, because I it sounds stupid, but that made a switch flip in my head where it's sort of like thinking about it as high turnover in like employment, where it's like you'd better extend that relationship because that turnover and finding a new brand deal in this case is expensive, and like you have to onboard them, you have to do all of these different things. So you want to prioritize long-term relationships, not approach this as a singular transaction or even like an us versus them type situation, which is super common because typically it's like, oh, brands are the bad guys, creators are the good guys. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way.
Yeah, it shouldn't be that way. I mean, typically what we are tempted to do is try to get the highest dollar amount possible as quickly as possible. And we don't think about the ROI for the brand right off the bat. But All of that upfront communication that you have with a sponsor is kind of a one-time cost if you then deliver a good campaign.
Yeah.
Because after that, you can kind of just like propose things, sign and move with it. We've worked with Uscreen for a long time here on the channel, and we've used the same ad creative for several videos. There's even efficiency in longer campaigns of you can reuse the creative. If you're doing single video integrations with new sponsors every time, not only are you having the entire process front to back with all those new sponsors, but now you're producing an asset that you're only using once. So It is sometimes better to err on the side of, I want to have a great first campaign with these sponsors so that they renew, rather than let me get the most I can charge possible from every integration and risk burning that relationship or not having the opportunity for a renewal.
Griddle with Johnny asks, at which point do you recommend trying to get sponsors for a newsletter? I'm at 6K. How do you get them?
Check out Griddle with Johnny's YouTube channel if you want to work with a Griddle. Super fun videos. Grateful that he's in our membership community, The Lab. But I like this question because people tend to think there is like this theoretical threshold of how big some platform needs to be before you can get sponsors. Before I was doing anything creator science related, I had this little podcast called Upside that had a much smaller audience, much smaller listenership. And for the first couple of years of creator science existence, Upside was still generating as much or more sponsorship revenue because we realized everything in terms of revenue you earn from sponsorship depends on who the sponsor is and how much a new customer or lead is worth to them. On Creator Science, I was sometimes having sponsors of like, there's a shirt brand called, I forget the name of it now. We had t-shirts on the show at one point, and those are like $20 per unit. But on Upside, we had professional service companies advertising with us. So it was like lawyers, accountants, bankers, executive recruiters. So if they got one conversion, that was well worth the entire sponsorship campaign to them. Meanwhile, I've got to sling like dozens of t-shirts over here to make that worthwhile. So if you have a smaller newsletter, you can sell sponsors today. If you can identify who has a high value for the type of people who are in my audience. And a lot of times it is like professional services or higher priced products where the ROI is higher per customer. The lifetime value is higher per customer. And you can approach them because a lot of times those people don't have the same opportunities to sponsor media companies either. They don't have a lot of people saying like, hey, team of lawyers, do you want to sponsor my podcast? Like no one's doing that outreach. So you can reach out to anybody at any time and propose sponsoring any of your platforms. Just start a conversation. The win is the conversation. You know, reach out and say, hey, my name is Johnny. I have a channel of 93,000 subscribers who really care about griddles and making great food outdoors. I use a Blackstone griddle, and I thought it would be a really great opportunity for us to partner to get you in front of all those viewers. Would you be open to a conversation? You know, start with that. You don't pitch and say, here's my channel. Will you give me $5,000 to be a sponsor? Have a conversation first. Build a relationship, as we're just saying. Start with the relationship first.
And if you want to go deeper into like the process of specifics of how do you contact people or things like that, the two episodes we did with Justin Moore are really good. He walks through his entire process, start to finish, from pitch to posting. So those will help a lot. Billy Samoa Celebi, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that.
We'll call you Billy.
Billy asks, what are some effective strategies for creators to stay motivated and inspired amidst challenges and setbacks? And then we'll add to this a similar question from Andrew Kaplan. How do you manage the emotional highs and lows that come with running your own business in public? What do you think, Jay? You've been doing this for a lot longer than I have.
Well, I can tell you the beginning of my even entrepreneurial journey, to Andrew's question of the highs and lows, I was so ill-equipped to deal with the lows that I basically like removed emotion from my life for a period of years in the beginning.
Yeah.
And that's not the answer is what I've come to know.
Yeah.
You can't rule out the lows without also like really numbing the highs. And it just, it makes things not worth it if you're not feeling any emotion. So, you know, the thing, what is it, like Vanilla Sky, where it's like the sweet is not a sweet without the sour. It's true. Like you can't have joy without also having despair. They're two sides of the same coin. So how do you stay motivated? How do you manage those things? The older I get, the more I realize how important it is to just like pay attention to how I'm feeling. Because in content, so much of creating content is a transfer of emotion. So if you're feeling emotionally low, any content you create from that place is going to transfer that emotion. And maybe that's a good thing because you're trying to connect with other people and show what it feels like to feel emotionally low. In my case, a lot of times I'm trying to inspire people, encourage people, and I don't want to be creating from that emotional low place. But if I get so in my head about discipline and publishing, and I make something anyway, it's just not quite going to work. So a lot of times I'm listening to myself and managing my creative times with how I'm feeling. And I'm a sensitive boy.
Same.
So in terms of staying motivated, what I really like to do is identify signals of progress. And you get better and better at picking out fainter and fainter signals of progress. You think that like the signal of progress you're looking for is 20 people commenting on your post and saying, I love this. This is the best thing I've ever seen. And sometimes that happens, but it's more of the exception rather than the rule. Really what you're looking for is like tiny little moments that point to you being on the right track. Maybe it's this video has a higher upvote percentage than others. Maybe it's the average view duration on this video is longer than others, or the click-through rate. Maybe it's I got one reply to my email newsletter that said, this is my favorite newsletter that I read. Anytime you see some signal that what you're trying to achieve is happening in a small way, you can usually extrapolate that beyond the one person that says it and say this person represents a quieter majority that is like them. And I like to say on Twitter that I'm like celebrating every milestone on the way up. That's partially me dealing with the negative emotions that also come with the journey.
Yeah.
If you lean too much into the negative emotions but don't enjoy the positive ones, then everything feels negative. It's on our biology actually to really focus and overemphasize the negative things. So you have to retrain yourself to actively identify and then take a moment to appreciate the positives and find, it's kind of a fun game. Find the smallest signal of progress that you can on a day-to-day basis and take some time to enjoy that.
Yeah. And I think for me, doing things in public has made me focus way more on following a North Star of like where I want to be, trying to separate myself from results and through like, especially on YouTube statistics, because goalposts move so fast. Like as soon as you get that million view video, like when we had Jenny's, it's like, well, why aren't we doing that every video? When it's like, when we first started the channel, if you would have said, hey, we have a 2.5 million view video, I would have been like, shut the fuck up. Like, no shot. But now, you know, if a video gets 10,000 views, you're like, oh, come on, it could have done better. But when you think about like, well, you know, why do I feel this way? And it's important to zoom out and being like, okay, my North Star for this year is personal development. So it's like, if something didn't do well performatively, well, did that still move me in the direction that I wanted to go? Like, am I still getting better at what I'm doing? Am I still becoming a better person or anything like that? And then zooming out and like what you said is hitting upon those little things of progress and thinking like, what would Connor 6 months ago have wanted? You know what I mean? Like, is this a problem that he would have dreamed for? You know, like three yeah. years ago or whatever. Is this what I wanted? Usually, yeah, like this stress or like this is exactly what I asked for. So why do I feel so bad about it right now? And it's just zooming out and putting yourself in that headspace.
It's also important to be choosing work that you care about the product itself. Because yes. if you're doing things because you think people will like it, when they don't like it, not only do you feel like you failed that goal, but then you also don't have a thing that you like. So you need to be choosing products and creating content that you like and you're proud of yes. and you would want to talk about in the future, regardless of how well it went. We have this video with Angus Parker on the channel that I think is super good, super tactical, yes. super one helpful to people who are trying to hire. Not one of our highest performing videos by any means, but I still find value in having that as part of our body of work. And it's something that I can refer to people and I know it will help people. So even if that quote unquote underperforms our typical viewership, there is value there. I've again, this is like the asymmetric thing of I've capped my downside and given myself potential for high upside. That's what I'm always trying to do.
And like two more tactics, like just little one that I learned from the Dr. K episode, which is great if you want to learn about mental health type stuff, especially as it applies to creators, is being intentional about how I look at things in data. Because a lot of times with social media, we just consume everything all at once and we're not mentally prepared to do that. So I've been super intentional about when I look at stats, when I'm receiving feedback, things like that. And the other thing is therapy. Like, you know, like go to therapy, even if you don't need it or if you don't think you need it. I think it's great. And if you are one of those people who don't have the financial means to do so, usually if you live in a college town, they have programs that you can do therapy with grad students that has oversight, or there are websites like Rise Above the Disorder or programs for queer people or anything like that, where you will get discounted or free therapy. So there's usually options if you can't financially afford it. Mitch Wilder asks, what is the method you've used to attract so many great people to do interviews with you on your YouTube channel? And how do you get them to open up so much about their methods?
These are good questions. And not a lot of people ask specifically the second question, which I think is really, really good.
Yes.
So in terms of getting people on the show, this really goes back to the start of the audio show in March of 2020. There had been, and probably still is, advice floating around that's like, if you want to build an interview show and you want big guests, you got to start with like B-level players and you can work up to A-level players. And I think that is total self-limiting garbage, because what I have found is anybody you invite on the show likely will check into, is this person legit? And they'll look at your background and they'll look at other people who have said yes to the question you are asking them right now. And they'll use that as like this litmus test of, do people like me go on shows like this? So the sooner you have the caliber of people you want on the show, the better. Obviously, it's a little bit of a catch-22, but if you do enough outreach or you have somebody with some connection that can make an intro and you can ask for a favor, the better off you are. The first episode of our audio show was Seth Godin. The second episode of James was James Clear. I had had a couple email exchanges with Seth, so that was something I pulled on, and James Clear lives in Columbus. He's a friend of mine. So I pulled in those two favors. Suddenly, when I ask someone to come on the podcast, I can say, I've interviewed Seth Godin and James Clear. And that makes it a much easier yes for people who know those people and think, well, they wouldn't say yes if there wasn't some value in it. So that's the answer of how do you get people on the show is I've had other people on the show and I make very direct asks with a very short email template. I can actually...
If I'm not mistaken, the Seth Godin and James Clear interviews, they are the first you posted, but those weren't the first you recorded, right?
Correct.
You had a bunch set up? Yeah.
Correct. And that's important too, because the first few interviews you do, if you're doing an interview show, are not going to be good.
Yeah.
And you're going to screw things up that you can't even predict. So it's better to have a couple of like practice interviews that you are comfortable with maybe not even publishing before you do these interviews. And like Connor just said, the order in which you interview somebody does not dictate the order in which you publish the episode.
Yeah.
A ton of people still go back to episode 1 and 2 of the podcast. So I'm glad those two episodes have guests that people recognize and are interested to hear from. So for the email pitches that I send to people, they're all the same. I say, hi, name. And then I have a sentence or two that are highly personalized to their work, how I know it, how I care about it. And it's very clear that I admire their work. And this is not a templated email. It's something very specific about the details they have, something thoughtful about something that they've posted, to just make it clear that this is a personalized pitch, because people want to feel special. If I get a ton of pitches myself. If I get a pitch where it's like, you clearly just wrote the same thing to me that you did to somebody else, it makes me feel like you don't necessarily want me, you want somebody. So you have to personalize the first couple of lines to make it feel like them, but you also can't share your whole life story here. That would be too long. So then after I make that relatability pitch or connection, I put in bold, would you be up for a 45-minute remote interview for the show? Usually in that first paragraph, I'll say like, I would love to have you on Creative Elements or Creator Science to tell your story. Then I say the pitch, I give the description. Creator Science helps people succeed as a professional creator. I'm talking to professional creators like you who have figured out how to make that work. Past guests include James Clear, Tim Urban, Tori Dunlap, Cody Sanchez, and more. So it's like social proof, social proof, social proof. People you've heard of have done this show. It's a high production narrative interview show on this network when I was on the network. It has 2 million downloads. It won a Signal Award and was featured in Apple Podcasts, CastBox, Stitcher, and Pocket Casts. Again, social proof. Worth your time. Then, and this is really important, I say, if you're up for it, you can schedule directly here. I give them the link to schedule. I don't want to create a back and forth exchange. If I've sold them on the idea of coming on, I want them to be able to take action, schedule time right there. I end it by saying, no rush. I'm totally on your schedule. Happy to answer any questions or find better times that work for you. Zero pressure or expectation. Thanks for the consideration. What I find a lot of people do to screw up guest asks is they'll make a great pitch and then they'll say, do you have time in the next week or two? Absolutely not. Nobody has time in the next week or two. I'm protecting any time I have in the next week or two with my entire life. No. But if you say, do you have time in the next couple of months? Then it feels like, well, of course I have time in the next couple of months or 45 minutes for sure. In the subject line, I actually put in brackets, interview requests, and then say, can we talk about your creative career? Because I think when people see that, they're like, ooh, someone wants to interview me? cool.
Like, yeah.
It works. I swear people open that subject line. So that's the pitch of how I get people on the show. And if it's not email, it could be a direct message.
And the like through line of that, which is similar to any pitch, is just making it as easy as possible and low lift to say yes.
Yes.
They don't have to do anything. All they have to do is click this link and then schedule a month or two in advance that, you know, yes, they might not think about again until the week before or something like that.
And I don't ask for their bio. I don't ask for their headshot. Like, your input is just scheduling a convenient time and showing up. That's, I want it to be as low friction as possible. And I want to give you an out for saying no without feeling like a bad guy. Now, to Mitch's second point of his question, how do you get them to open up so much about their methods? You know, I would say two things. One is, I think tone and inflection and how you speak to somebody is the key to how that conversation goes. You can ask pretty direct, almost personal questions with a tone or with inflection that invites a response or invites like defensiveness. So if I ask somebody like, so how much money do you make every year? Yikes, feels bad. Feels like you're interrogating me. But if I say something like, man, so you've been growing at 100% year over year. What does that look like in terms of revenue? Much more inviting to respond to.
Yeah.
There are other like specific techniques. Sam Parr talks about some of these where like if you're trying to get a number, you can throw out an absurd number first. Like if you're asking them about revenue, you could be like, so you're generating like $10 million of revenue every year. If it feels absurd, or if people are just like really proud of it, they'll typically give you the real number. I'm not big on getting people to say things that I think they might regret sharing publicly.
Sure.
But it's really about tone and inflection, and both of those things lead to what I would call assumed rapport. If you don't have a pre-existing relationship with this person, there's still some amount of rapport that you can assume that you guys can have. You can go too far. You can go too far and make it feel like, I don't know you. Why are you acting like we're friends? But if you assume good intent and assume some level of openness, that typically leads to people feeling comfortable and opening up a little bit.
And I think from the editing perspective, what I've noticed is not asking people to talk about themselves. You want to switch it onto either have them problem solve with you or talk about very specific situations or hypotheticals. So when they talk about themselves, no one really wants to talk about, or I will say, unless you're interviewing someone who's like super media trained, who is used to being like, I'm Connor Conaboy, I do this, I've done this, I did that, then you're going to get a very scrambled answer where if you have an editor, it should be cut. A lot of people don't, but it should be cut because there's so much dead space and people don't really know. But if you ask somebody a very specific problem-solving question that involves either a hypothetical or a specific situation, then their brain flips to like, oh, I'm more active in this conversation. I'm not reflecting. I think that's the big difference, is reflection versus being active in teaching or talking about something that your audience will be, or that will be valuable for your audience.
That's a good way to put it, because a lot of times I do say things like, so let's imagine that I am this person in this situation trying to do this thing. What would you say to that person? Like I make it less, it feels less invasive. It like gives them the gift of projecting and feeling a little less attached to it, I guess, in a way, but it just feels easier to answer, I found.
Well, and they don't have to think about it that much, because it could be, for example, where you'd be like, in this video, you said blank. Could we talk about that as it applies to this? Or in this video, you talked about this concept. How does it apply to this situation? Where it's like that very active problem solving. You're not dancing around the bush, where a lot of times I've seen interviewers, they'll kind of like dance around a question, expecting the guest just to answer it for them and to like know what they're thinking. But you kind of guide the active conversation to get what you want, to get the exact information you want from that person in the interview. There's been literally times where in our prep documents, I will like write a note to Jay being like, hey, try and get them to say this thing or to talk about like this specific situation. I want this quote, especially with people who I know are good speakers. Like I did it with Justin Moore. I did it with John Yusha. I did it with Patty, where it's like, I know we can get them to say something that we can clip and is a really good hook and is super valuable for the audience. Let's try and do that by talking about this situation that leads us into that.
Yes.
Joe Kearns asks, common advice is start with one platform, but that seems hard with YouTube. Video could be my strongest content, but it seems more challenging and resource heavy to get initial traction. Do you start with YouTube anyway, or just X/LinkedIn and use that audience to grow YouTube later? I think the first thing is YouTube is definitely challenging and more resource heavy than those other examples.
Yeah. And the second thing is nothing grows YouTube other than YouTube. So you're not going to get an audience on X and LinkedIn to care about YouTube later. I think the question of when does YouTube enter the fray is a question of how much conviction do you have that YouTube is a big priority for you? Because if you have high conviction, then you want to do it sooner rather than later, because it is more resource intensive. But there's also a lot of, I find there are more skills involved in doing YouTube well than any other platform. And you have to develop those skills. And you can only do that through practice. Like I've been saying lately that theory is learned and insight is earned. You can learn the theory of YouTube, but if you really want to like earn the insight of how to do YouTube well, you've got to get practice at doing it. So if you have high conviction that YouTube is something you're going to do, start soon. And if you don't have any resources to allow you to do things outside of YouTube at the start, that's just fine, because YouTube can build your entire business. Like YouTube can be the engine for everything, even if that is all that you do. I've been blown away that lately, Connor, I've been getting a ton of followers on Instagram, legitimate people. I'm not even posting on Instagram. And when I asked them, they came from YouTube.
YouTube is more likely to grow those other platforms than other platforms are to grow your YouTube.
100%.
I think the other side to that, that I would caution you, is looking at where should I create content from a performance standpoint and not like, what am I good at? What do I want to do? And that's the thing, is where you could feel that YouTube could be your strongest content. But if you're a writer, it's probably not going to be where you want to start. It'd probably be LinkedIn, maybe Twitter. And then the opposite, where it's like, if you're a performer and video is your thing, then just focus on YouTube and then figure out the other stuff later, because it is so resource heavy. I think trying to split your time or evaluate something on where should I be is different than like, what am I good at? What do I want to be good at? What do I want to make? That kind of thing.
Yeah, those are important questions. If you have high conviction that you want to do YouTube, then dive in, start doing it, find a way. You may not have the resources or connections to hire great talent to help you. You might be doing a lot of it on your own in the beginning. And you know what? Mm-hmm. You're going to learn a lot doing that. But the sooner you start the clock and start getting practice, the better off you are. And the great thing about YouTube is it's typically, I would put it under the bucket of long form, quote unquote, unless you're doing shorts. But I would put it under the bucket of long form. And the great thing about long form content is there are lots of pieces of long form content that can then be, I wouldn't say repurposed directly, but used as inspiration for short form content. If you're doing a YouTube video about four ways to clean your carpet, each one of those four ways could be their own self-contained post on LinkedIn or on X.
Kiwi Dad asks, I have a decent following, 80K on Insta and 30K on TikTok, in the parenting niche. I've experimented with free books and got maybe 100 downloads. I want to create a course to support new parents, but I'm worried the time investment to do this won't pay off since my audience doesn't seem to leave socials much. Any advice?
Well, Kiwi Dad, I can tell you that my first course I made quietly without warning people that I was making it. I actually made three courses and spent 6 months doing it, put together this whole launch campaign and had two people buy. And it was a huge flop and I felt like an idiot and it was miserable and sad. So I'm glad you're asking the question before you go and do all of that. because there's a couple of very simple things that I would recommend doing that make this a lot easier. The first is I would just do a presale. Like instead of building the whole course, I would think about what are the benefits of this course that I am promising? What is the outcome that somebody taking this course would get? Let me do the work of making a sales page, a basic sales page that says, here's what I'm thinking for the course. Here are the benefits you're going to get out of it. Here's what I'm going to teach in it. Here's when it will be available. It's available now at presale for this price. I've done presales in the past, and typically what I've done is say, here's the retail price. For the next 2 weeks on presale, you can get it for X percent off. And I've done 50% off at times. And then I've set this bar to say, if 10 people buy it, I will make it. And if 10 people don't buy it, I'll refund it. You can either make that very public or you can just tell that to yourself and say, if 10 people buy it, then I'm going to make it. If 10 people don't, then I won't. And that's a very, very good barometer of do people want this course? And will they tell me that? Not even just tell me that, but like tell me that with their wallet.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge, huge validation. That can de-risk the building of your course. And we had a similar question from Breast Cancer Rehab about what steps to follow to start selling your first digital products. And this is the same advice I would give you is think about the benefits. The temptation people have is to get really feature-minded and say, this is what I'm gonna teach you. There's gonna be 40 videos and 5 hours of content and all these modules. And people don't want like more stuff. They want the outcome. They want you to say, this is a benefit I've achieved in my own life. Here's proof that I've achieved it. I'm gonna make that benefit available to you. All you have to do is pre-order this course. And that's as simple as it is. You can separate the delivery of the information from the promise of the outcome. Sell the outcome. People don't care about the delivery as much.
One other thing to think that's more on the technical side, but when you mentioned I've experimented with free books and got maybe 100 downloads, I think that's also an opportunity to look at how you're selling. Outside of that is like, how are you pushing that in your videos as far as download or as far as getting downloads or whatever goes? Because there are good and bad ways to do that as well.
A lot of selling is confidence in the product.
Yeah.
And where I see a lot of people, and particularly I see this as a struggle with YouTubers who have been creating free content for a long time. People tend to think that people purchasing your product is like them doing you a favor. But really what you want to have is an equal exchange of value, where it's like walking into a Starbucks. Like you walk into a Starbucks and the barista is not trying to sell you on any particular thing. They say, this is what we have. Do you want it? Here's the price. If so, they just know the value of their product and you come in because you're looking for that. So a lot of times, even if you have this free ebook, it should be, hey, if you want this outcome, I have this great free resource for you and you can get it at the link in the comments or the link in the description. Have a lot of confidence that what you have created will provide an outcome. Because if you're not confident, then the viewer is not going to be confident in it either.
Blair Sharp asks, what's your warm-up and prep routine for when you do public speaking?
Well, Blair, I wish I had a great answer for you. It's not great. Here's the honest truth. I've done so much public speaking for the last, gosh, at least 10 years that I'm really leaning on practice at this point, but there are a few things that I've learned are really helpful for me as an introvert. One, I typically tend to not plan anything else before the speaking thing. If it's like even if it's a late afternoon event, I will typically like hide most of the day leading up to it and run through the presentation, sometimes out loud, sometimes in my head, but run through it so I know that I'm hitting my beats. The presentation itself, I typically tend to have a visual aid and I will go really slide heavy with minimal design on each slide so that it's not so much about memorization, but I have like a visual cue all along the way. That helps me a lot. I have found that if I eat a big meal before speaking, that's a big problem because my stomach presses on my lungs and I tend to get out of breath and it's a bad time. I get out of breath, I get anxious. So I actually tend to go into public speaking fairly, if not hungry, like I've just snacked to avoid hunger, but I haven't had a big meal. I typically try not to have coffee before public speaking because either I will be speaking too fast and get out of breath or I tend to get smacky is what LinkedIn calls it. I'm actually breaking a cardinal rule right now by drinking a coffee on this podcast. And I know like I can hear it in my own microphone that there are mouth sounds that I don't want. Water is typically what does better. Maybe some water with lemon.
It's a good thing there's an editor here.
Yes.
Take those mouth sounds out.
Editor, audio engineer, all of it is helpful. Which you can't have most of the time when you're public speaking. So water, light food, practice, visual aids that set you up for success. And I think that's it.
Jamie Wilkie asks, when is the best time to start a private community? I am eager to start one, but want to make sure the juice is worth the squeeze. You've been doing this for a long time. What are your thoughts?
I have. I think that private community or membership is what I call a paid private community is one of the best products that you can create if you have conviction and interest in it, because it can be a little bit of a slow burn. And depending on your pricing model in the beginning, it can feel like a lot of work for not a lot of financial return. So I do think you have to be really thoughtful about the design of this thing in terms of pricing model, what you're promising to deliver for people, even how often that the subscription renews. A lot of people assume they need to have a monthly and annual option. In the lab, our membership community for professional creators, it's annual only because that place is built on relationships. I also know that the return on your investment is going to take months to play out. So I don't want to give the option to come in, pay for a month and leave. It's not good for the culture of the community, and it's not setting the right expectations of how long it will take you to see success. So you really have to think about the pricing model, who it's for, and what this looks like day to day in your life, not just in month one, not just in year one, but 3 years from now. Do you still want to be doing this 3 years from now? If the answer to that is no, then it might not be worthwhile. But if all of that is true, I think the earlier you start, the better. People think that you need to have a ton of people at the launch of it. But Connor, you and I met through my first private community. And when I started that, I had 5 people to start.
Yeah.
And then it was 15. And then it was 35. And, you know, it took a year to get the first like 40 people in there, I think. And in the beginning, when it's small, you have the benefit of having a lot of context about everybody. I would over-index on live interactions. If you do it in person, that's amazing. If you aren't in the same place, doing it on Zoom is the next second. Because when you have live interactions, people get to know a face and a name. They see people moving in their own space. It builds real relationships, and people get invested in each other's success. So when I see a face and a name in a forum or a Slack channel or a Discord channel, and I know who that person is, I'm more likely to take the time to help them out or engage with them because we've had a real time interaction. So start sooner, get 5 people in there and over-index on real time conversations. All right, Connor, I think that we did it. That's a lot of listener questions.
Let's
go. I really enjoy making these videos. It's fun to chat with you on this and go back and forth. So I'd love to hear if you're still watching this video, did you enjoy this? Do you want to see more Q&As with Connor and I? If so, leave a comment down below about what you liked, what you would change, or if you just want to see more of these.
Please do. He locks me in the basement and lets me out to record this.